to the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show and founder of Yes to Life, the UK's integrative cancer care charity. Integrative cancer care is a description of a style of cancer care that attempts to address all the many needs of someone with cancer, physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual, to support people through what, for most, is the most challenging experience of their entire life. It's an increasingly sophisticated science that explores the full potential of combining conventional care with an enormous range of complementary and lifestyle approaches and is delivering better quality of life and longer lives. My guest today is Nicola Nuttall, someone who's explored the full breadth of integrative cancer care in the search for help for her daughter Laura, one of the rapidly increasing number of young people afflicted by a rare cancer when their life has barely begun. Integration was to help Laura live a far longer and better life than she might have otherwise, but has left her family on a mission to do more for others facing similar circumstances. Nicola, many thanks for coming on the Yes to Life show.
Hi, Robin. Thank you very much for asking me.
So I've only come across you quite recently, but it seems that we've got quite a bit in common in terms of the stories that brought us both into the field. And by that, I mean working very hard to change the face of UK cancer care. Central to both our stories is a precious daughter, in your case, Laura. And as parents, we both felt motivated by our experience to do something to try and help other people with cancer and have set up a charity. So in your case, this was Be More Laura, which is focused on brain cancers. Now, I definitely want to hear that story of exactly how you got here, if you're up for sharing it. But first, I wonder if you could tell us what your experience with Laura has told you about cancer care and why you're so passionate about change and what changes you'd most like to see.
Oh, that's a big question. I think what shocked me most was I never expected my daughter to be diagnosed with cancer to start with. She was 18 in her first term at uni. You know, it was the last thing we ever expected. But then I had a belief that the NHS would kind of wrap its arms around us and say, well, this is how we fix this cancer. Because every time I pick up a newspaper, it says new development in cancer treatment and
breakthrough.
So it feels like that just cancer in general isn't a death sentence anymore. And that was certainly my belief and my experience of people that I knew. I know people who with leukemia and prostate and kidney cancer and breast cancer that have gone on to live long and full lives with cancer being very much in their history rather than something that they were dealing with. And I mistakenly thought that was the same for all cancers. So when I found out that brain cancer was the biggest killer of children, cancer killer of children and adults under 40. And then I find out that it's funded by about 2% of the national cancer spend. I realize that rising tide of research and development and improvement isn't lifting all the boats, and that the focus is very much from a utilitarian point of view that I understand, but it's focused on the big numbers. And for pharmaceutical companies, it's not just the big cancers, it's also things like diabetes and the money that they can make from things like Viagra, and the little orphan drugs that sort out rare cancers are so low down the list. Mm. And it was a massive shock to find that this wasn't just my experience, but everyone that's dealing with a rare or a less survivable cancer. And suddenly, when you hear an advert on the radio from CRUK and they're talking about we're curing cancer, it's all I can do not to throw something at the TV, because we're not curing cancer. We might be curing some cancers, but it's just not a level playing field. And that's been the biggest shock for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And in terms of the changes you'd like to actually see, I mean, yeah, some more money put into it for sure, that'll be first. But are there other changes about the way that rarer cancers are approached that you would like to see?
Yeah, I'm very keen for a right to try, because I feel that everything that is available, obviously and understandably, has to go through the NIHR and through NICE before it's approved. And that makes perfect sense. However, when it comes to things like repurposed drugs that we know are safe, and there is at least anecdotal evidence that they can improve the outcome, it's really, really hard for clinicians to make those available to people with a rare cancer, because it might be licensed for melanoma or prostate, but it's not actually licensed for brain cancer, even though we know that the genetic connections mean that there's a strong chance it will be at least make some kind of difference. But we don't have that right to try. And there is something very similar in Germany, and there's something similar in the US, but we don't have that. I'd also like to see some of the things that are going through in the Rare Cancers Bill. So that had its second reading in the House of Lords last Friday. And that's making a person responsible and accountable for the rare cancers. And I think that would be a great start, because it would hopefully mean that somebody would actually understand why they need to be treated differently. And in the case of brain cancer, how heterogeneous they are, and how 10 people will all have different genetic makeups and different drivers of their cancer. So why do we just give them all the same one kind of chemo? So I'm hoping for that. And the other thing in the bill that makes me feel a little bit enthused and positive about the future is the incentivization of drug companies to look at the orphan drugs and to look at what we do with things like patents, and to just make that an area that is more attractive to them, because the charities at the moment cover so much of the cost of research. And with brain cancer, I believe 85% of research is funded by charities. And that's a ridiculous situation, and it's sustainable. So if it's not the charities, it needs to be the government, and it needs to be drug companies.
Right.
So we need to make that something that happens.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. It's good to see the government doing stuff on our behalf. You sometimes wonder whether they're really too bothered about, actually working on our behalf in that way and just leaving it up to business to do it, which, of course, is another playing field that their interests are in profits, and so they're not going to attend to something like rare cancer. So, yeah, we have to actually put some welly behind it in order to get some of these things to happen. So, very interesting. So be interested to see what comes out of that bill. It is a step.
And it is a step. It's not everything, and it doesn't have things like we need more money to be funneled into that area. You know, we need to get, I think getting a bill through Parliament, it's better to keep it as simple as possible to actually get it through, and then you can build on it. If you make it too complicated, it's less likely to be approved. So at least if we start with something, then we've got some sort of foundation to build upon.
You had a bit of momentum. Yeah, no, that's good. And you definitely will have raised awareness along the way as well. The other matter you were mentioning about the kind of flexibility that clinicians have in treating somebody who's terminal, it's extremely frustrating to not be able to try out things that are known to be safe. They might not work, but if they do work, they might actually learn something from it. I think it was Lord Saatchi who came up with this description of ovarian cancer of endlessly repeating a failed experiment, which is what they do. They give the same treatment, it doesn't work, and then they die. I mean, absolutely senseless, really. Why not try something else, which is not going to be, cause suffering, and see if that works better? I'm sure any number of the patients would be up for trying it.
Yes.
So, it makes complete sense.
And that's definitely the way that Laura looked at things. If she tried something and it worked, or it didn't work, either way, it's a learning experience. And if you're given a 12-month prognosis, then it feels like the biggest risk is doing nothing. Because
absolutely.
Really strange situation when a clinician is saying to you, don't look at the internet, don't look outside of the NHS, but we're giving you a 12-month prognosis. How can those two things make sense together?
I know. Stop. This whole idea of things being being dangerous when actually you're going to die anyway. There's no proportionality there, really.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think when we buy an insurance policy or take out an investment, we're asked to look at risk and to basically plot ourselves on a chart of risk and to say right. What we would be prepared to take. So if you want to take a high risk approach to investment, you might lose all your money, but you might gain. And I really feel like we need something similar to deal with risk in cancer treatments, particularly with rare and less survivable cancers, because the clinician's attitude is we take no risks. We take no risks at all. But the patient often feels very different about that.
Yeah.
And there's no meeting in the middle there. It's very black and white. You either do it our way or you don't.
Yeah.
And so what ends up happening in my experience is people do all kinds of different things, but they don't tell their clinician.
Right.
And that feels dangerous in itself.
I know it's daft.
How many people have done that?
Yeah.
Because the clinician quite often will say, well, if you go outside of my recommendations, I don't want to treat you. Mm. And I do understand that to a degree and from a point of view of responsibility and risk to their professional qualification, I guess. But at the end of the day, the patient should be able to tick a box that says, I'm prepared to take risks and I take those on my own head.
Absolutely right. That's the thing, is that people taking responsibility for you when you don't want them to is beyond irritating. It's positively parental. So, people should be able to say, yes, I'm prepared to try this and tick the box. It's fair enough. They had to sign to say that they do absolutely take the risk. But as long as they absolve the practitioner of the responsibility of the outcome, then what's to lose? So, completely with you there. It's part of the mismatch that means that patient-centered medicine is still a long, 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 long way from being delivered at NHS, is that they're more worried about their own backsides than about what the patient wants and needs.
Case often is. And that's a real shame, because I'm sure that there are lots of doctors who would prefer to think outside the box and support their patients. But the way that the system is set up, it feels incredibly risky for them to do that. So they're reluctant.
I agree. It's the system that needs to change, yes. Yeah, a lot of the clinicians are well inclined to do a much better job in that way if they had the freedom. Hmm. Okay. So in terms of life-size experiences like this, your story is really pretty recent compared with mine, which was 20 years ago. I wonder, are you happy to share it with us?
Yes, I'm happy to share. I always take any opportunity I can to talk about Laura, because she was an extraordinary person, and I'm sure you feel the same about your...
I do, yeah.
Yeah, well, Laura was in her first term at university at King's in London studying international relations. She just spent the whole summer in Chicago, where she managed to inveigle her way into the governor's office to work on the midterm elections. So she'd been out from A-levels onwards, and she'd found this herself and found somewhere to live, and she was having an absolute bore. She got the A's that she needed to go to King's and was kind of about 6 weeks in to her first term, and she phoned me up and said that she'd been having a few headaches. And as I always have migraines, I thought, that's a really unlucky inheritance. I'm sorry about that. She joined the Royal Navy University unit, and they sent her for a medical. And she'd just run her first marathon, so I didn't expect them to be any issues there. But they sent her for an eye test at Boots in Westfield, and basically they wouldn't pass her because they said there was swelling behind her eyes. They sent her to Moorfields Eye Hospital, and they said they couldn't really see anything. But when she phoned me up, obviously alarm bells are ringing in my head, and I'm thinking, well, that sounds very strange. She said, there's nothing to worry about. They're going to refer me, but it'll be a couple of weeks, but it's all fine. And the next day, I couldn't get hold of her on the phone. And when eventually she picked up, she'd put her phone on silent because she had the worst headache of her life and she was really sick. So those two bits of information together meant that I kind of raced down to London and took one look at her and took her to A&E that night at Homerton with my other daughter. And because we had this information from the optician, they did a CT scan probably about 2 a.m. and they said that she had probably 2 brain tumours at that point. She had a further MRI and CT the next morning, and then they said it looks like it's about 8 tumours. And what it actually was a multiform tumour which spreads like tentacles, really, like the tendrils of a plant, and it spreads throughout the brain. So we had to pack up her university halls, everything that we'd only moved down 6 weeks ago, and bring her back and find a surgeon. And fortunately, they were able to operate, and the operation went really well. We were told she might lose her speech, but she woke up and she was actually exactly as she was. And so it felt like we'd won and that she was going to be fine. But obviously, a week later, we went for a meeting following the surgery, and they told us it was glioblastoma, which is the most malignant primary brain cancer, because at that point they didn't know whether it was a secondary or a primary. And glioblastoma has a prognosis of about 12 months. So she went from literally passing her A-levels, being at university, to being told she had a year to live. And she said to the surgeon, well, does that mean I can go back to university later this year, or do I need to wait till next year? And he said, I'm sorry, Laura, you'll never go back to university.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
So we started then with the radiotherapy and the single type of chemo that's available for people with brain cancer. And it's all that they've had available for 20 years, more than 20 years now. Nothing's changed in that time. And in that period, we started a bucket list because Laura's friends were all obviously away at university and she was stuck at home and all her journeys were to the Christie for the chemo and back. So she was having a really tough time of it. And the bucket list kind of gained a momentum of its own and she was doing all kinds of things. We flew off to South Africa and went on safari. We went to New York to watch Saturday Night Live being filmed. She met Michelle Obama. She drove every possible vehicle she could. Went fishing with Paul Whitehouse and Bob Mortimer. Just a million crazy things. And we filled her time. But amazingly, she actually applied to go to Manchester University to study philosophy, politics and economics. And she applied while she was in the midst of radio and chemo. And I thought, well, it's good to have something to aim for, but I don't think that's very likely. But I should never underestimate my daughter because she did go back to university and she was living in halls, even though she was really quite sick with chemo. She was very determined to be living away. And whilst that was all going on, I was researching other things we could find for Laura because I just refused to believe that this was as good as we could do, that a treatment that's been stagnant for 20 years was as good as it was going to get. So we looked initially at a dendritic vaccine, but unfortunately the tumor tissue that was removed and would be needed to make the vaccine wasn't properly stored or saved. So that was ruled out, which was incredibly frustrating when we'd specifically asked for it. But I found a clinic in Germany that were able to offer something similar. So it was a vaccine, but it was also electrohypothermia with Newcastle disease virus. And it was a clinic called IOZK in Cologne. And we went out and had a meeting with the professor, and he explained how it worked and how she'd had the electrohypothermia alongside her chemo. And then when that was all over, she'd have the vaccine. And he said, you'll need to come out every kind of 4 weeks. And the idea of it just seemed so enormous and huge. I said, well, how on earth are we going to come out here for a week every month? But it's amazing how things that seem impossible are doable if you take them one step at a time. So that became something that we did. And what even whilst Laura was at uni, we were going out for a week every month, 5 days, and Laura would have treatment there. And it was relatively simple. It was without side effects, without pain. So we just got used to spending time in Cologne, and Mark and I would take alternate months. So my other daughter wasn't totally abandoned by her parents. And we actually enjoyed the time that we spent in Cologne. And then COVID happened. So Laura came home.
All right.
It was a blessing. But we still needed to get out to Cologne every 4 weeks. So that became a real challenge. And then so we then took ferries out while the ferries ran. And then when the ferries stopped, we had to basically put a plea out on Twitter for ideas of how to get to Cologne when no one was
okay.
Anywhere. And people were suggesting military flights, and people with little aeroplanes were offering to fly us over. But then we came across a company who, an investment bank, who had private jets that they weren't using through COVID. So they actually loaned us their private jet, and we had five different flights back and forth. But we were the only people flying anywhere. So we'd have to contact the
consulate. How amazing.
Oh, it was amazing. And we had to go through the consulate and get permission. And even then, when we arrived, because it's a federal government, we never knew whether we were going to get permission to land or to literally arrive in the country. So it was quite a stressful time. But the kindness of strangers has been astonishing. And that funded, essentially, the treatment that Laura had. So Peter Kay did two shows for us, and they raised lots of money. But our local community, people on the internet who'd never met us, donated to our GoFundMe. We had sponsored head shaves and sponsored races and sleepovers, and the community just pulled together so much. And Laura was very... she couldn't understand why people were doing it. She said, you know, all this money, we could fund a school in the Yemen. And she found it really hard to accept the kind that she accepted it, but she found it hard to understand why people were happy to help her. But we saw the best of people. We really did. And she graduated in 2001 with a 2-1, which was incredible. And just to see her actually walk up there and get that certificate was quite the day. In that time period, she had a further 2 brain surgeries, because the nature of brain cancer is if the radiotherapy and the chemo leaves one cell behind, that cell will take hold again and it will grow. So no matter what we did, we knew that we were never going to outrun it. It was always going to find a way around. But we did everything we could. We threw the kitchen sink at it. So Laura was taking full extract cannabis. She was taking most of the supplements available and known to man. I probably most of them. She raffled what I was buying. Because I was reading so much, I was finding evidence for drugs that weren't readily available. So I was buying them from clinics in India and, you know, taking ridiculous risks, but nothing that I regret, because, you know, I do the work on the side effects and check that there was no counterindications of matching two things together. But we did everything. I mean, we tried every single thing that we could to give her that quality of life. And she lived really well. And she wasn't unwell for that 4.5 year period. She was only really unwell towards the end, the last couple of months. Our last ditch attempt, when the electrohypothermia wasn't going to cut it anymore, was to go to a clinic that was recommended in Dusseldorf by our professor. And they used the same dendritic vaccine, but they used an Amaya and a catheter directly into the tumor area. So she was doing things that were quite experimental, but unfortunately she had 2 rounds of radiotherapy at this point, and the skin on her head was very thin. So then we had issues with the skin healing up, and she ended up with an open wound essentially underneath, and that became the big issue. And although she rebounded after that with the use of Avastin, which is another drug that we had to pay for privately and is not available for brain cancer, she bounced back and did really well. But we knew we were just pushing it away and the gap got smaller and smaller. And sadly, we lost Laura 2.5 years ago.
Right.
Age 23. And tricky journey.
Same age as my daughter. Yes, one amazing story there. Incredible. All that you're saying about your GoFundMe, I mean, we run schemes like that for people. I think they're brilliant. They just, as you say, they bring out the best in human beings. Brilliant things. We've done them for years. And even the people who are kind of resistant to the idea of putting themselves out in that way, they get won over by it as soon as they actually do it, by the flood of goodwill that comes their way. It's very inspiring, and it's a huge part of the kind of group healing that we capitalize on more and more at Yes to Life, is when you get a group of people together who are somehow all gunning for the same thing. It's a very powerful thing for people's well-being. It really affects them deeply.
Yeah, completely agree. And we were bowled over by it. One gentleman saw us. We did quite a lot of media. Laura's story got picked up and was all over the place for a time, and one man saw us on This Morning and got in touch and said, I've got this house in France. I've got a really nice house in France. You and your family should all go. And essentially, he lent us this huge farmhouse in France. He paid for it all off, like the car, yeah, everything. And we went out 3 or 4 times out to this amazing house in France. And just the absolute kindness of somebody that didn't want anything back, didn't want any publicity, just wanted to do a good thing. And it's easy to lose sight of the goodness in the world when you turn the news on, isn't it? It's
very
dark
easy
times, and people feel like they're all out for themselves, and there's lots of selfishness, and there's lots of intolerance. But actually, when it comes down to it, people are basically good, and most people will try and help somebody if they possibly can.
So I would describe your approach as kind of leaving no stone unturned, which we were up for the same ourselves. But, you know, you take advantage of whatever conventional medicine has to offer, but you look everywhere. And basically, I think the results speak for themselves. I mean, for her to have 4.5 years of life with that diagnosis, it's pretty incredible, and it's rare, isn't it? Most people, they said a year and they mean a year. That's really it for most people.
Yeah, absolutely. And so why wouldn't you try?
Exactly.
Why wouldn't you?
Why wouldn't you? So, you know, kudos to you for going that route, and for probably creating a fantastic time for her in many ways. And amongst all the difficulties, I'm sure there were some absolute highs. It sounds like it.
Definitely.
For you and, you know, for your whole family. So brilliant.
And I think you have to deal with what's in front of you, don't you, and try and make the best of the situation. But that we took that from Laura, because I never saw her cry about her own diagnosis. I never heard her being sad or sorry for herself. She just took it on the chin, and she said, well, if it wasn't me, it'd be someone else, and I'm not, you know, there's nothing special about me, so why should I be immune to these things? But you never think that would happen to your family, do you? You think these are the things you see in films, these are storylines, they're not real lives.
Yeah, unfortunately they're becoming more and more common, of course. That's the actual truth. So look, I want to talk a bit about what you do before we get to the end of the show. Yeah, so Be More Laura, the charity you set up, has been raising funds. What do you spend them on?
We spend them on research. We have made some individual grants to people as well, when we thought that we can help them individually. But our focus is very much on research into glioblastoma, because it's so under-researched and nothing has changed, as I keep saying.
Right. I'm sure an awful lot of people would be really shocked to hear what you said about 20 years using the same chemo. I mean, ours was the same experience, you know, rolling out. Bryony had cancer when she was 9, and when she was 13, and then again in 22. And at 22, they were still doing the same thing they did when she was 9. You know, it's like, hello, all that hype and money and everything, and nothing moves
it's
on.
Madness, isn't it, to keep doing the same thing and expecting this? I mean, anecdotally, I've been told that the chemo that they use, temozolomide, works in 7% of cases. I give it to everybody because we haven't got anything else to offer. So it's almost like, well, we've nothing, so we might as well try that. And you might be in the 7%. But meanwhile, you're going through sickness and...
It's horrible. It's horrible. And of course, probably they can actually test to find out whether it would help you or not if they wanted to.
Very
through
much.
Genetic testing.
Methylation status is basically the indicator. But even though they do that, they don't implement it. But then again, I suppose if they said, we think it won't work, so we're not going to give it to you, then you'd think, well, let's try it anyway, because unless you can offer something else.
Well, yeah.
At least it's something. But Neil Armstrong's daughter had brain cancer. She had a form of DIPG in 1962.
Mm-hmm.
And really, nothing's changed since she treated. She had radiotherapy, and
shocking.
It's really very little that's happened since.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
That's why our focus is on trying to find treatments that work for that. So there's various things that we've supported. One is the medical cannabis alongside this chemotherapy, Sativex, and that's a trial that's being run from Leeds under Professor Susan Short. So we're doing
great
inside the Brain Tumor Charity. We've also helped to fund the work that Petra Hammerlink is doing in Manchester, and that's more about diagnosis than treatment, which is also hugely important because that can be a really long and slow process. And she is working on the use of tears as an early diagnostic for brain cancer.
You mentioned this to me before. Fascinating. I've never heard of anything like this. Yeah. So there are features in your tears that will signpost the fact that there's something wrong in your brain.
Potentially, because if you think the fluid, you know, the connection, just in terms of the geography, it's very close to
where
that fluid is. So that's really exciting. And that could speed up that process because I think it's an average of 7 trips to a GP before you get a diagnosis.
I bet.
Might not change the outcome, but it might mean a tumour is operable rather than inoperable, which is kind of very important at that early stage. So we've helped to fund that, and that's really exciting. And I believe she's also working on the importance of the gut biome in terms of recurrence and success or lack of success with treatment. And then the thing that we're more involved with this year, which is very exciting, is the use of focused ultrasound, which I feel optimistic that will be an option for many cancers, not just brain cancer. But the companies that we're working with are specific to that. And essentially that uses, I mean, it's very sciencey, and I'm not a scientist by any shape or imagination, but it uses focused ultrasound in tumour areas. And it's that's used alongside a drug called 5-ALA, which is something that they use in surgery already. And what that does is it highlights the parameters of the tumor. So it makes surgery easier because it uses fluorescence and you know where the healthy tissue is as opposed to the tumor tissue. But that drug goes into those tumor cells, and then the focused ultrasound essentially explodes those cells. The sound is turned to light, and then that explodes the cancer cells. Amazing. It's repeatable, has no side effects. It's being used in the US at the moment under slightly different conditions. It's being used in Italy, and it's been used for Parkinson's in the UK because it can get through the blood-brain barrier. So this is really exciting.
Yeah, I mean, it's been licensed, I think, for quite a long time now for some other kinds of cancer, but I haven't heard of it being used for brain cancer. So, yeah, interesting commonality to all the things you've described is they're all on the kind of non-toxic side, the side that's likely to not give huge side effects and this kind of thing. So that, I assume, is a result of your experiences you had.
Yeah, I mean, Laura didn't really suffer. She suffered sickness and fatigue through the radiotherapy and the chemo, and that was horrible to see. The only time she really suffered with side effects was when, unfortunately, her oncologist forgot to weigh her for 6 months, and so she was given far too much chemo to her body weight. He was basing it on her steroid post-surgery body weight, so she was about 20 kilos lighter, but the chemo hadn't changed. So that was really unfortunate. And she was really unwell, and that wasted some of her time. So that was the thing that was most frustrating, that time that was spent, you know, up through the night being sick and in bed through the day was just wasted time for her. But obviously surgery is significant.
Yeah.
Surgery is huge, and it can go horribly wrong. And we had an amazing surgeon in Salford who operated on Laura, I think, four times in total, and he did a great job, but not all surgery goes so well, and the consequences of surgery not going well are huge and life altering.
Absolutely. As you said, she could have not been able to speak, but obviously did an amazing job. Yeah.
I don't think there'll be one answer to brain cancer. I think it will be a mixture of things. It will be a cocktail of treatments, and it won't, there's not going to be a silver bullet, but there will be things that you can use in conjunction that will improve the outcome. I strongly believe.
Do you have some things in your sights that you also want to trial?
Well, there's interesting things happening with, there's a drug called vorasidenib, which is, the NIHR has approved it for low-grade glioma. It hasn't been trialed for high-grade glioma, but it should be. Unfortunately, NICE did not approve it, even though we know that it actually works. And that's really annoying, but they can't, at the moment, quantify the actual value of it because the people that are taking it haven't died yet. So they can't work out whether that works in terms of the £35,000 a year value of a drug that NICE work to. So I'm very infuriated by that. And all the charities that I work with are all really, really campaigning for that. We seem to have another stay of execution, so it's going to be looked at again later this year. And I think the drug companies tried to put that back so that £35,000, which has been increased from 25, can maybe be applied.
These kind of things that seem to be pragmatic decisions look very different when you how your daughter's life is on the line, don't they?
Oh, absolutely.
Immensely frustrating.
Yeah, immensely. In fact, you know, there's a lady that I'm meeting up with later this afternoon who has brain cancer and lives within a couple of miles of us. And she currently has her house up on a raffle site. She's raffling her house to pay for cancer treatment. And that's the cold, hard reality of fighting a disease that's undervalued and under-researched.
Yeah, thrown back again on the American situation where, yeah, people spend their whole life savings on medicine. Horrible. Do you want to just briefly tell us, you're involved in two other organisations. If you could just briefly tell us what you do. This is Brain Cancer Justice and Our Brain Bank. So you're busy there. So tell us what you get up to on those two.
Oh, there's so many more. So there's actually another one called the Angel Mums, and I'm part of that group. And we raise funds for the Tessa Jowell Pediatric Centers of Excellence, and they're all mothers who've lost children to brain cancer. And in that group, I feel lucky that I had Laura for 23 years, and some of those mums only had their children for 2 years and 3 years.
Yeah,
it's absolutely heartbreaking. And we have done an Earth, Wind and Fire challenge, which involved things like wing walking and fire walking. So yeah, there's some really tough, strong women in that group that are really campaigning to make things better for children.
Right.
I'm a trustee of our brain bank, which is glioblastoma specific. And we have a UK and a US part of that charity. And we're campaigning for whole genome sequencing and for the storage, the safe and correct storage of brain tumour tissue post-surgery. So it can be used for sequencing, for vaccines and for research. And I'm also part of a group called Brain Cancer Justice, which in a way kind of combines all of those things together. And it's a patient-led group, patients and families. And we're just trying to move brain cancer up the political agenda, raise awareness. We have a huge petition that we're trying to get 100,000 signatures. We're up 50,000. We're trying to get to 100,000 to raise the debate in Parliament. But we've spoken at Holyrood and at Westminster and at the Synod. And we're just working really hard as a group. It's headed up by Georgie Maynard, who actually has GBM herself and is quite incredible. And it's just an all-encompassing group of people who just want to see things change, really, however we do that. So there's lots of people really passionate about change. And some of those have lost the person that they love, but they just want to improve the things for those that follow them, which I think is incredible.
Like yourself. Yeah, that's great. It's really great. So one other thing I just want to hear about before we finish is you've written about your experience of losing your daughter in a book. It's called The Stars Will Still Be There, What Losing My Daughter Taught Me About Life, Love and Hope. So even though these are massive questions, we're going to have to be quite speedy about it, all right? But I actually would like to hear about all of those, starting with hope, which often comes with a kind of health warning about false hope on it. Have you come to view hope through the experience you've had?
Well, if you haven't got hope, you haven't got anything. And I think there's always that feeling that maybe you could be the one, because there's always outliers and there's always people that defy the odds. And certainly with Laura, we felt like there's probably only her in the whole world that was having that exact combination of treatments.
Yes.
So you could be the one. You could be the one. And
absolutely.
And there's also the hope in each day. And Laura was brilliant at this because she would always see the positive. So we'd go for a walk and then you turn around and go, where is she? And she's taking pictures of an insect she's seen or a flower or a tree, because she really saw the joy in the smallest things. She wasn't always like that, but her diagnosis really changed her. She appreciated being outside and she appreciated her family and those things that were incidental maybe when she was at her most ambitious became so important, and it really changed her attitude. And she did so many fantastic things for charity herself. And we have an event that we put on in our children's play center where we cook Christmas dinner for 200 people on Boxing Day and everyone gets presents. And that was Laura's idea. She helped out the food bank so much. And I think she was hopeful that if things didn't change for her, then it might not be too long before they changed for other people. But writing the book, it came from a journal. I was basically journaling our experiences as we went along, not just Laura's, but what happens to the whole family, because there are consequences for everybody when you deal with something so life-changing. And Laura's little sister went from being 16 to 21 during that period, which is a key time when she needs a mum. And I was off to Germany and I was focused on trying to keep Laura alive. So it's about relationships as well as about dealing with cancer. And it's very, very honest about getting it wrong as well as the things that went right. And it's really about Laura's attitude to life, really, her positivity and how we took that as our guide, really. I couldn't have written it now if I tried to. I couldn't have remembered everything, no, to be honest. I'm really glad that I did. And so many people have contacted me to say that it's helped them go through their own journey. But people that aren't on a journey like that have said it's just changed their attitude to life, which is amazing, really. But it's made them appreciate what they do have.
Right. So that, in a way, answers the second thing in that list of about life itself And I think your relationship to life has changed in a similar kind of way of appreciation, mm-hmm. it sounds like, awareness of what we have. Do you want to just say something about the last point, what your tragic loss has shown you about love?
Well, it's a powerful thing, isn't it? I think as a family, as a mother and a father and a sister, it's like that thing where you see old ladies lift up cars to save to save their grandchild. It's very much like that. And we had to learn so much, and we had to do things that were so out of our own comfort zone, but there's nothing that we wouldn't have done to save Laura. And the love of strangers as well. You know, I talked about the kindness of strangers. That's love. It's love for other people. Gosh, it gets me emotional every time.
Me too.
We truly have seen the best in people. You know, one of the things on Laura's bucket list was she wanted to have afternoon tea at the Ritz. And somebody local to us was insistent that she had a voucher and she wanted us to have it. And her husband had given it her for her Christmas present. And she was adamant that Laura should have it. And you just think, you don't know her. You've no idea. This is a present you've been gifted. I mean, as it happened, the Ritz were shamed into actually just doing it for us anyway. That we were able to give it back to her. But you know, those kindnesses. And there was an old lady in our village who had a whole load of currency that British currency that was the old edition, as it were, you know, when those old notes went out. She brought them to the post office in our village in Barraford and said, I don't know where they live and I don't really know any details, but can you make sure that that family get this money?
Amazing. Yeah, as you say, the very best of people comes out. And it's extraordinary, the ability of love to be the vehicle for change. It's really, I think, the only reason that people really change is for love. Nobody wants to change, and you can't blame them, really. We like just being as we are. But with love, you simply have to. As you said, you had to do everything you could. And so you had to go beyond your safety barriers and all the rest of it and just get on with it.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Anyway, thanks for speaking so openly about your experience today, Nicholas. It's been a reminder to me, really, of so much that's happened for me. And a lot's changed in the last 20 years, but then there's other things that simply haven't.
Mm.
And they're going to need an enormous push in order to get them to change these things. They're very happy with the status quo in many ways, and we're not, are we?
Absolutely. And
so we're going to push very hard and keep pushing. So really great to have met you. I think we're singing from the same hymn sheet. I hugely admire what you've done, what you're doing, and I'm very pleased we've met.
Oh, thank you so much for asking me. It's lovely to talk to you, and I think, well, I'm sure your daughter would be incredibly proud of the work that you're doing.
I think she'd be pretty amused, actually. Anyway, thanks a lot.
Thank you. It's really nice to talk to you.
Okay, bye now, Claire.
Take care. Bye-bye.
If you want to find out more about the work of the foundation that Nicola set up in Laura's memory, the website is at bemorelaura.com, just as it sounds, where you can also support the hugely worthwhile research initiatives that we've been hearing about today. The programmes for the Yes to Life conferences, that's online on May the 16th and in person on September the 26th, is building, and we already have a world-class lineup of presenters that includes Dr. Nature Winters, David Hamilton, Dr. Leo Prunboom, Raj Jana, and many more. The program's being developed in partnership with the amazing Dr. Sam Watts, and both conferences go under the title Reclaiming Our True Nature: What Science is Telling Us About the Impact of Psychological, Emotional and Spiritual Factors on Survivorship. You can already snap up a super early bird seat at both events by visiting the conference website, which is conference.yestolife.org.uk. You can also get there by clicking the big Find Out More button that's on the rolling banner when you arrive on the main Yes to Life website, yestolife.org.uk. Thanks so much for listening to the show. I speak to a new guest every week, so I do hope you'll come back for next week's Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.